What's the basic premise of the whole 4 weeks?
Personhood.
Personhood. Yeah, more.
Mind and body.
Yeah, yeah. You try and form sentences rather than just words.
Going against the creative order.
Yes, I'd certainly talked about that a lot. But what's the sort of... The premise of the book is that a number of areas...
You separate the mind from the physical body.
Almost.
That's the premise, isn't it?
Almost. That's not quite the right terms, but... You separate something from the physical body.
Spirit.
No, we might say spirit.
Personhood.
Personhood. So you were right with the person thing, but you needed to form a sentence around personhood.
What personhood separated from the body?
Personhood separated from the body has been the basic argument of the book, Love Thy Body, which is, this is the philosophy which is a sort of child of Greek philosophy and of some of the 19th, 20th century French philosophers, the idea of separating the person from the body. And once you've done that, then the body just becomes biological material that the person kind of uses at will. That's been like the big thing. If you haven't got that as the big thing, I am well depressed. Listen to me being well depressed. What a state you're making of things. Would you like to trip over something as well on your way? I'm going to give you a handout because we've now taken the mickey out of you quite enough. I'm here.
Thank you.
Cool. Okay. This is like a really hard first in question. And it's a bit awkward, really. What are the contexts / relationships for people engaging in sexual activity? I kind of softened it from sexual intercourse or sex to sexual activities. It's a bit less. That could be one.
Married.
Married could be another one.
You said anything.
Prostitution.
Prostitution, see, yeah, anything like that.
Friends with benefits.
Could be that. So it could be someone who's a friend but who you're not actually in a relationship with.
Peer pressure.
Could be a peer pressure for some kind of a rite of passage with some random... Abuse, absolutely. So are the contexts that are maybe building on any of those? Some bloke you met in the pub, some woman you met in the pub.
One night stand.
Yeah, that sort of thing. When you kind of list them out, it's a bit depressing. Is it a bit depressing?
Yeah, was that any?
Yeah.
Any kind of anything engaging with someone could turn out to be.
Does that include
like
cyber sex?
Well, do you know what? Exactly what I was going to go on to ask about. So, yes, it includes that as well. So, that could be a term for sexual activity or a context for sexual activity. So, I suppose here's the core question to do with tonight. So, if those are all the different contexts, and there are, I suppose you could think of loads more, there are sort of ones that are basically taboo, which might be sex with children or sex with a relative, close relative. So there are those to kind of think about as well. But if you put all those together and you say, well, these are all possible contexts in which you can have sex or experience some kind of sexual experience. Why is the Christian way good that says, okay, you've got all these options, but I'm going to narrow you down to this one?
Boundaries, isn't it? I mean, it's like a...
Why is that all right? Was the question too long? Sorry.
Glorifies God.
Yeah, that could be an answer.
Less consequences. You're only accountable to one person.
Yeah.
Security, isn't
it?
Yeah.
That's kind of saved you maybe from abuse and... Yeah.
Yes.
Somebody abusing that.
Yeah, and guilt and all kinds of things.
Yeah. And unwanted pregnancies.
And... Yeah, all those things. I think what we've also been trying to say for the whole 4 weeks is that there's the command, but there's also the goodness of the command. And the command is reflected in the way that we're made, both bodily and spiritually. So when we're arguing with people, we argue the command, that which is basically Philip's point, which is, it's for the glory of God that we obey God and follow his pattern. So that's the kind of command aspect, to say, okay, so the reason we narrow down to the exclusive relationship of marriage is because God commands it. But the other reason we do it is because it's good. And you've got to believe both those things. You've got to believe you need to obey the command, but you also believe God is good. So you think obeying the command must be good as well. And every time we break out of that command, it's not so good. Now, God has made, you know, remedies for that, but that's not what he intends or what he plans. So just working our way towards how we got to where we are, where people are engaging in sexual activity at all kinds of levels, as in not like different stories in a building on the first floor and on the 12th floor, but at all kinds of levels, in the sense that sometimes one night stand, sometimes someone at a party that you vaguely knew, you know, I'm like oldish, but I remember people when I was at work, I was an apprentice from 16 to 20, you know, people at Christmas parties getting off with each other, and stuff like that. So all kinds of contexts, part known, part not known. And then there are sort of girlfriend-boyfriend relationships, and then there are people who are living together but not really committed in marriage, and then there are people who are engaged and living together, and then there are people who are married. So there's all that going on. How did we get there? How did we get there? Where it's going on at all those different, in all those different contexts. Yeah? I am like producing really bad questions, aren't I? It's clearly not working. Sorry.
Seeking self.
Shirley's going to help me.
Seeking self to just do everything that I want to do and not what everybody else wants me to do.
Yes. Yes.
Well, it's the whole separation of the context from the action.
Yes.
And promoting a sense of the context is irrelevant.
That's what I was looking for.
Because
it connects with this. It connects with what we've been doing. That people are have managed to separate, and it's not like it's never happened before. We read about it in Romans last week. So that progress, the idolizing of sex, it happens in cycles. But I suppose culturally, as we are at the moment, we are in a more sexualized state than we were. If I'm going to say that word anymore, I'm going to have to close this door. More sexualized, otherwise you're just going to keep hearing sex all coming through the door. Sex! Sexualized state than we were 100 years ago. Some things are better, some things are not so good. Part of how we got there was through the sexual revolution of, really, people talk about the 1960s, but before then, actually, in terms of the romanticising of love. You know, people often say, you know, it all went wrong in the 60s, but actually it all went wrong in the 18th century to do with romanticising love, to the point that the aspects of duty and commitment were devalued and romance was the highest value. Once you do that and make it the absolute... it's not to say it's all about duty, so don't get me wrong. But once you make romance the absolute, then eventually when society kind of changes its belief of God, all that matters is romance. And you can have romance for 20 seconds. You can have romance with people of the same sex or different sex. You can have romance with a child. There's actually no limits if you elevate romance to be the governing principle. And actually, that idolizing of romance happened during the Romantic period. And that greatly influenced things. And then a whole kind of disbelief in God that happened during the First World. I'm giving you like some social history thing that you did. It's not nothing to do with the book. But anyway, so that was an influence. And then the two world wars, which kind of shook people's belief in God. Although there was kind of religiousness during the two world wars, there was also quite a sense of, you know, how could God allow that? So you're kind of shaking off the societal belief in God.
Do you mean like the Holocaust and stuff?
Yeah, yeah, and well, the First World War, the trenches, and lots of people dying in the First World War in a very sort of brutal way, and lots of people dying in the Second World War too. Yeah, yeah, but there was a lot of disillusion after the First World War as well. Disillusion, becoming disheartened, becoming, depressed. I can't think of a synonym for disillusioned. Not so happy. Yeah, disillusioned with religion, though, and with God. That sort of idea. But yeah, I mean, the Holocaust was a big one, you're right. But, you know, if loads of your mates die, you start to try and rethink your morality, and there was lots of stuff that went on. You know, there was lots of American romances with English, not lots, but a significant number of with English brides who were left behind, and their guys were soldiers and all that sort of thing. So lots of ingredients actually during that time for the kind of immorality that exploded in the 60s, because you had a sort of embedded now kind of evolutionary view of the world. You had a kind of shaking off the view of God. You had the idolizing of romance. You had loss of disposable income and disposable time because of sort of mechanization and everything. So all these things kind of were ingredients that helped all that along. Okay, that's nothing to do with what's written down here, but I think it's mostly true. But none of you are going to contradict me. But I think it's mostly true what I'm saying. Okay, so a different question, because I think how we got there, well, that's the big social history thing. How we got there in terms of the sort of immediate is what we do with our kids and what adults are doing and what adults are educated to do. So just thinking about that. So answer this question, whatever it says on the sheet. how are children sexualized from an early age? What? Give me some examples of that. How do toys sexualise children?
Being a Barbie doll.
Okay.
You've got these dolls called, I'm on the track, you're looking like I'm not giving you the answer that you wanted.
Are you on it?
They're called Monster High dolls. And it is, I've never seen anything like it before in my life. They're like emaciated, like women like figures with like crop tops and mini skirts and
like the big eyes,
like high heels, and like
big eyes the thing, yeah.
There's like a cartoon
and like
for
baby
it
toys.
And it's like sold for like Violet's age.
Okay.
It's like it's horrific.
Just to understand, I know what you mean, but just so you vocalise it, what do you mean? Why is that sexualising?
Well, I think because kids look at that and want to be that, don't they?
Okay.
They role play that and they say, you know, I want to be
and dress their toy.
Yeah.
Okay. How is that connected with sex?
At all. Because they dress, from my opinion, these dolls look very, like, sexualized. They look like the clothes that they wear. And like a Barbie and Ken, Ken's a boyfriend, they're encouraged in, like, relationships and, like, you know, and then there's a Barbie and Ken wedding, which I guess isn't too bad if you're a Christian. But it's still a bit weird. Like, I don't know.
As long as it's a Christian sermon at the Barbie and Ken wedding, it's all right. But no, I mean, you're saying it, but they're dressed in sexually attractive ways, in what would be classically considered sexually attractive, sexually alluring ways.
Yeah.
And the fashion supports all that.
Yeah, so fashion. What about child? I know we had a few discussions about this with some people here. What about that? So how does fashion sexualize children from a young age?
Well, if you dress them like adults.
Yeah.
Or shorts, or like short skirts.
Yeah,
like
highlighting their
yeah.
boobs or their bums or, you know,
yeah.
Just making them like, you know, like denim shorts where you can see their underwear.
Well, like really, I don't like really tight clothes. I personally, on small children, I don't like, Violet, like leggings and stuff, like I guess, but like really, yeah.
You see, I was thinking about this when I was making these notes, and I was thinking, yeah, I was thinking all those things, and then I thought to myself, I thought exactly what you just said, which is dressing like adults, and then I thought, well, that must mean adults are dressing in sexually attractive ways. If you think there's a problem with children dressing in miniskirts, exposing their boobs a lot.
That
must be a problem with adults as well.
It is a problem with adults as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not just dressing like adults, it's dressing like adults who are not dressing very
modestly.
Cool.
And then you've got all the, you know, pop icons and things that the kids see, and they're already, you know, everybody, all the kids at school talking about them, like, you know, and they're all dressing like a bunch of hookers as well.
Yes.
Like a Little Mix.
Yeah, a Little Mix.
And then the lyrics of their songs, you know, I mean, it's just about sex.
The lyrics haven't gotten much worse, actually.
No.
The 30s, 40s, and 50s are just as bad.
Yeah.
I remember listening to a thing about something where they compared
them, but it's still not good. I think now, then you've got the lyrics, like, supported by all the social media stuff.
Yeah. You just see it, yeah, the videos that go with it.
And then movies and TV and internet.
I thought about this. We're just becoming like a grumpy old men here, but I was thinking about this to do with dancing, and I was trying to figure out whether that was sexualizing children. So teaching children dances that are basically, I don't know what you'd call them, sexually alluring moves. Yeah. Is that a fair description? Yeah.
That's why I don't dance.
Yeah. There are other reasons too, but yes. But then I was thinking, you've got to make sure you're being consistent about that, because if it's wrong for a child, it must be wrong for an adult, possibly. He's thinking about it anyway. You could say, well, adults have a bit more material to process it with, I don't know. So sexualising through dress, through possibly dance, through songs, through television shows, some of you said.
Role models.
Role models, yeah, who are all kind of talking about that. So that's going on with... Chuck, go on.
Well, you... the later in the school, in all the sex education stuff, in a way, you get sexualized through the sex education because they talk nothing about relationship.
Yes.
And it's all about, well, you better go do this, or like, you're going to be good at doing this.
So just do it safe.
Quite so. Yeah. That's in my notes as well.
Yeah, it is. I thought it was particularly relevant at this point.
No, it's good. It's good to get it in there.
That's not precisely what
it
says.
No, it was not. No, it's good.
TV adverts.
Adverts.
That are on like in the day, like there's one for like teeth whitening, and yet she's in a bikini. I'm like, what? Like, I don't quite see your point there, but okay. Like, do you know what I mean?
Is it good teeth whitening stuff though?
Yeah,
I'm using charcoal toothpaste at the moment. It's very exciting. It's black. Look at my teeth. Hey. No, it tastes all right. It tastes a little bit like licorice.
Yeah, they do this cheese at the witch that's got charcoal in it. It's the best cheese in the whole world.
That's not Black Bomber.
No, Black Bomber's not that.
It's not black.
No, it's the wax around the outside of Black Bomber, but the inside of the
yeah.
This cheese was actually black.
You, because we're too far off track. We're rolling back.
Sexualisation
of cheese now as well. I think we probably covered it, but how is adult culture also giving a low view of sex?
All the same stuff, isn't it?
I think so.
Well, all the relationships in TV programs and films are in a loving relationship or in a marriage.
Very few are.
Affairs.
Yeah. Okay. It's a rubbish ending, by the way.
It's a rubbish ending, by the way. It's tense. It's definitely tense.
Turning the news off because they kept saying last
episode was amazing.
So many millions watched it or something.
But yeah.
Also, just it shows lots of different kinds of relationships. There aren't a man and a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just the whole thing of go with your feelings again, isn't it?
Yeah.
You want to have sex with him, go and have sex with him. Why not? You deserve to.
I I've lost my notes for it, but I was listening to a Radio 5 show the other lunchtime, and what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
It's not about you. Nothing to do with you.
Radio 5 was I felt like I was really the same age as what's his face, Johnny Prime at the weekend, because he listens to Radio 5 as well. No, he's the same age. He's born in
1962.
What does that mean, he's the same age as me? Mean surprising because I look much younger?
No, he looks younger.
Honestly, that was what I was going to say.
No, it wasn't.
I thought you were younger. I promise you.
He's got more hair, though. Which he can, like, he can do things with his head. But I can't do anything with my head because I've just got nothing there. He can, like, pat his head like he does sometimes and say, that's not me, or, you know, he can do stuff with his hair. Can't do that. Anyway, I was into Five Live, lunchtime, and the kind of phone in the topic, you imagine this is like a two-hour topic, which is on polyamorous relationships, meaning multiple sexual partners.
They've done a few articles on BBC about that.
Yeah, it's a thing. Maybe it was because a TV series was coming up that they were sort of talking about. So there was a whole kind of phone in, and people were phoning in, and there were a number of really disconcerting things. There were blokes and women phoning in and saying, "Yeah, I've got my sort of partner, but then I have other sexual partners, and mostly my partner doesn't mind that too much, and she realizes that I can kind of, or he realizes I can sort of get satisfaction elsewhere, and they're quite happy with that." And there was a guy that phoned in and said, you know, and just occasionally I have sex with blokes, you know, and so that was disconcerting what they were talking about. But I suppose what was even more disconcerting was the uncritical interviewer. It was Nahal, I can't remember his second name, who used to be on Radio 1. Anyway. He was the kind of, and he said very affirming things, like he kind of was a little bit incredulous at some of things, but he'd also then, someone would say something like, well, this is how I feel, and he would say statements like, these are not like cliches, people actually say them, you've got to follow your feelings, you've got to be true to yourself. He was saying all these kind of things. There wasn't even a suggestion that this could possibly be wrong or damaging. So that is where we have got to. This is a kind of mainstream, middle lunchtime. Here I am with my Marmite and my peanut butter or whatever, listening to something, just talking quite openly about this with not a single voice that is critiquing that in any sense.
There's loads of like magazines at work that say, like, I've easily read like 5 where it said that that's like where people have quoted saying polyamorous relationships saved my marriage.
Right. So what are you doing reading that?
What am I doing reading that?
I haven't seen it, but the trailers for it, so it's a married couple whose marriage has gone stale, so they now decided to go and go out with other people. Mm.
So I think it's just worth noting that all these kind of cultural pressures are happening. The book talks about, this was my kind of fourth bullet point here, that talks about the hookup culture, which is slightly an American phenomenon in universities, colleges as they would call them, but it happens in universities here and in sort of a bit more in youth culture here, I think, but maybe it happens in older culture too. But the idea of just hooking up with someone with no relationship. There's a really interesting example. So this the lady goes to a university to give a talk on something or other, and a load of guys come up to her afterwards and say, "What I really want to ask you about is how do I actually go on a date?" So there's these guys who have had lots of sexual relationships who are really worried because they have no training. They have no categories for working out how you'd actually have a relationship with somebody. And like a whole crowd of them gathered around her, and then she gives an example of someone who's kind of made a sort of career out of giving dating advice to guys at university who are having lots of sexual relationships but not dating. And in the book she goes on to kind of describe that the whole culture in quite a lot of detail. Often there's a lot of drunkenness and drugs involved because people can't stand people but they kind of want to have sexual experiences, so they kind of do them. The 20-somethings that she was meeting in college have actually never been on a date. They've only just slept with people. They've never even been on what you'd call a classic date. I remember I was reading this maybe during the summer, and I messaged my family to say, can you guess what the two top drugs, you've got the answer there, but the two top drugs in USA student pharmacies are, or sort of on-site doctors. The two top drugs, and they all kind of guess for a bit, but the two top drugs are antidepressants and birth control pills. The fascination is that those two things are the top two, because those two things seem to go together. So as it says in the bullet point, the adult culture is telling young people they're mature, they're ready for sex, they can be uncommitted and emotionally detached. And actually, although you could say it's worse and more exaggerated in universities, it spills over into adult culture where you may, for all kinds of reasons, want the kind of romantic element as well, but they don't have to run in tandem. The relationship doesn't have to be the same as the sexual relationship. So the emotional connection doesn't have to be the same as the sexual connection. So they might converge in that you get married, but likely as not, they're running at different speeds. So most people that you know who are not believers would expect to have sex and have had a number of sexual relationships before they get married, and they would expect to have sex with their kind of latest girlfriend or boyfriend fairly early on, and then kind of expect the emotional to sort of catch up with it at some point later. That would be the general cultural norm, that the emotion catches up later, or it doesn't, in which case you kind of have to break up. But they don't run at the same speed, that those sort of the bodily commitment and the physical commitment. That would be adult culture.
It's like all the American Pie, wasn't it, maybe?
Yeah.
It's all like that. It's exactly
Like you
just said.
Yeah. Yeah. And coming back to the sort of personhood thing, it's and I think blokes are slightly worse than this, to be honest, that for blokes, that commitment to the person is kind of gets in the way. So you only really want to get involved with the person if you kind of have to, or if there's some convenience. And that's why you get lots of guys who don't want to make commitment, because commitment involves a commitment to kind of know the person, to help the person, to love the person, whereas having a sort of sexual relationship doesn't involve any commitment as such. I'm kind of telling you what you know, but it's kind of helpful to maybe just say it out loud. As Adam said just now, sex education focuses on your water's in front of you, that way. Focuses on the biological and the health perspectives, not the relational aspects. This was true when I was doing this apprenticeship. For some reason, when I was like 16 years old, going to a sort of training school, they gave us sex education lessons as sort of people who are actually at work, which is quite a thing. But
you didn't have a school.
Didn't have much at school. Sex education lessons. I was in an apprenticeship at a training place. 16. I'm not saying it was late, because we'd had a sex education at school. But the sex education school was one biology lesson by Mr. Pett, who just for one biology lesson just described the whole thing. That was our total sex education lesson, was one biology lesson that kind of went through the whole biology. He described it really well, gave us all the information we needed, actually. But even then...
CGI. Is that what you do at your school?
Oh. What do you mean makeshift blue people? You don't mean people where they've got heat sensing, so they just show the...
No, as in like they make CGI characters, but they're blue, like, without any faces. But
okay.
Are there any aids to help parents teach their kids about sex the right way?
There are some books.
We didn't have it.
Yeah, yeah. There are... and I can point you to some of those resources. So that's an interesting point, actually. I was looking at some the other week, and you just reminded me that I need to look again. So yeah, good question. All I was going to say was that there wasn't much relationship education now. Now there's lots more sex education, but there's still no relationship education that goes with it. Hardly any. They call it sex and relationships, but the pretty much it's all about being healthy and having some degree of consent, which is sort of what they mean by relationship, that you're both kind of happy to do it. That would be the kind of, you know, make sure you're in a relationship and you don't kind of exploit someone, or but that's about as far as it goes. There's actually not in sex education, I don't think, anything really about committed relationships or anything like that. And actually, love, marriage, family, children are not terms that are used in terms of sex education, other than avoiding most of those. Marriage, family, children. They're optional extras. They probably will diminish sex. Our cultural joke would be, you know, you have great sex until you get married or something like that. That would be the sort of cultural joke that's around. Most people, particularly blokes, but actually it's an increasing problem amongst women, learn most of their sex knowledge not at school, not at college, but actually online through the kind of the soft porn of most films and the hard porn that's kind of available online. This is an American statistic, but the average boy starts watching pornography at age 9. So by the time they could be sexually active, they could be sexually active at sort of, you know, 12, 13, 14, but by the time sort of most reasonably sort of stable family, educated people are sexually active, they've been watching porn for maybe 5 to 10 years by the time they get there.
Is that really true?
Not age 9. Apparently so. It's an American statistic, but it's apparently true. The average boy starts watching porn age 9. Now, obviously, the average means there are some who aren't watching it at all, who change the average, and there are some watching, have seen some before then, and so forth. But that, you can look at it in the book, and you can look at the reference. The source for it, yeah?
When our kids were in primary school, we had a big meeting for parents, and they told us that that age, and
it was our first school assembly, you know, parents meeting, and they were starting their first year of school,
right.
And we were warned about the sex going on in the senior class.
So many years ago.
That was in like...
What's
the first
year school? 35 years ago?
How old are they?
Just on 6.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently from a UK survey, half millennials, I've forgotten the definition of millennials, but I think you guys are millennials.
Yeah.
I think. Mm. Maybe you are, Mia.
It's born in 2000.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. That's why they call them millennials. Of course it is. Half the millennials in the UK have given up hope of having a monogamy. I think it's a broader definition. I think it's not literally 2000, but it might be. You might be right.
He's going to Google it and tell
you. Yeah, no, I'm sure he is. Half of the millennials in the UK have given up hope on having a monogamous relationship, meaning with one person. We've already said this. Virtually nothing in the media shows sexual restraint as a good thing. I think the only place where you could say this self... What's the answer? Born in 2000.
No,
I thought it was broader than that.
It's people reaching young adulthood in the early 21st century, so people
Correct.
Born between 1981 and 1996.
Correct.
Do you know what I thought, but I couldn't remember it, but I thought it wasn't quite that.
So you're a millennial.
Look, yeah, he's so old. How can he be a millennial?
It was 81 and 96.
Yeah.
Between 81 and 96.
But that's about 20 years old at 2000.
Yeah. So you guys are millennials, I was correct.
You're
baby boomer?
Yeah, I'm a baby boomer. I'm definitely a baby boomer. What? Yeah, so you're not one?
She's consoling me.
It's right, I'm not one as well, I'm really
Neil.
You're baby boomers, yeah. Which sounds much better than millennials, doesn't it? Sounds like we like got something going for us.
Yeah,
she is Generation X, yes.
65 to 80.
Anyway, half the millennials, your guys' age, have given up hope on a monogamous relationship. That is a staggering statistic, even if it's only kind of half true, that it's only half the half. If half the people think, I'm never going to be with someone who's actually faithful to me, that is just colossal as a kind of cultural signal. Virtually nothing on me. Sorry, I was on the religious bit. I got distracted now with the millennials. Pun?
I'm saying it's probably a true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only way in which our culture tries to elevate sex and to kind of make it a spiritual thing is the sort of portrayal of it. So although basically it's a person body split. Where you say, well, it's just a bodily function and my person can be engaged or not. That's mostly the idea of the book. But it also makes the point that there is a kind of veneer, like a cover, of trying to make it like a really super special thing. So pornography, hard pornography doesn't generally do that, but most other cultural stuff would give the idea that there's some significance with sex. We have this kind of weird relationship with it, that on the one hand we think it's as low as just a biological function, like, you know, eating a bit of toast if you're hungry, but on the other hand that we kind of think there is some significance to it. So it's seen as a sort of a religious experience that kind of provides redemption and kind of release, and so dramas kind of lead towards that kind of sexual experience, all in the wrong way and outside of any covenant and all the rest of it, but as some kind of a sort of moment of having sort of arrived at a happy place, as a fulfillment kind of thing. So there is a kind of religious element that's going on as well. Proverbs 30:20 is a really good verse. If someone just wants to find it for me, Proverbs 30, verse 20. Be well quick.
Either the electronic or the physical efforts.
I think Jackie's going to get there.
30:20.
Yeah, 30:20.
He who walks with the wise grows. 30.
No, you're right. We're going to go with Jackie now we've got this far.
Yeah,
you just have to hold off you two with your electronic devices.
Restraint.
Restraint, a bit of restraint.
This is the way of an adulteress. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done nothing wrong.
It's a fascinating proverb, isn't it? This is the way of an adulteress. She eats and wipes her mouth. It's the ultimate sort of proverb for our age. Obviously, it's talking about an adulterous woman, but it would work too for a man. That it's considered... You see the idea of wiping your mouth? The idea it's just a simple consumption, like eating a bit of toast, like, you know, having a snack, like having a big meal. But it's just a thing, and you wipe your mouth, and there's no consequences whatsoever. It's a great verse to kind of sum up our culture. No, I'll say it again. Yes. She's not. It's a metaphor. It's to say, here's an adulteress, so someone who's had sex with someone else's husband, and it's as though she's just had a simple meal, and wipes her mouth. So it's a metaphor to say, it's nothing else. It's just saying it's as though she just wipes her mouth and says, there's no consequence, I've done nothing wrong. It's like, it's as simple as, you know, there's a few crumbs on my face, I've wiped my mouth, that's the end of it. There's no consequence. It was a consumption. So that's what it is. Yeah, does that make sense now?
Yeah.
That's why I think it's brilliant, because I got quite excited about that verse when I found it, because it kind of sums up that whole consumer thing and no consequence thing. Sexual hedonism, as it says, gives sex too little importance. I think we might finish early today, but there we are. The body is nothing other than a physical organism. I did have two sets of notes tonight, but I can't get it working on my thing. So I'm just working off these notes. So if I read a bit too much, that's why. I've got nothing else to help me over here. Okay, so that's our cultural context. Any questions or comments about that? Anyone wants to say anything about that? Anyone depressed about that? Yeah.
It's not talked about by the students as much as you might think.
No.
Not about once the sixth form anyway. Lower down the school, I think, is worse than it is in the sixth form.
Right.
Actually. Just maybe encourage
it. Well, you mean like talked about, as in like just in.
It's what the kids are always talking about. They're always talking about. Girls are always talking about boys. And boys are talking about this one. But. generally. But yeah, just the number of times we've had meetings about finding things on students' films as heads of year and what we do about that and what do we do when we find pornography on films. And they send photos to each other constantly.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they think nothing of it. Mm-hmm. And they're not even embarrassed whenever it gets sent by the school.
Well, you're quite proud of it.
Yeah. It's the fruit, though, of a culture that where the adults are behaving like that. What is really helpful in the book is, I kind of went over it quite quickly, but the reason we're sexualising children is because we've over-sexualised adults, and it's just trickling down. As it says, bullet point number one on the second page, let's cheer ourselves up with God's way being the good way. Biblical sexual ethic has a high view of the body. It has a high view of the body because it says the body is a temple of God, the temple of the Holy Spirit, that the Holy Spirit lives in us. And it uses that as a rationale, actually, for being careful what we do with our bodies. So it has a very high and elevated view of the body and of sex. It doesn't have a low view of sex, like it's a kind of grubby little thing over here in the corner. It has a very high view of sex, but as used rightly in a body and soul that's aligned with God's purposes. It's a really interesting fact that in some of the old translations, for example, in Genesis, instead of saying Adam had sex with his wife Eve, if you haven't looked down already, what does it say instead of that?
He lay.
Sometimes? Other times? Yeah.
I know it is.
There was a clue in what Matthew just said.
I know the answer.
Yeah. He knows his wife.
Yes.
I remember that.
Why is that? Why is that interesting? Quite so. So it is a euphemism for sexual intercourse, but it's a very interesting one because, and it's a kind of Hebrewism that first line. Bible uses no as euphemism for sex.
I thought you'd just written
the
sentence.
Yes. They could have done with inverted commas there, like, I was in a bit of a hurry yesterday, I'm sorry. And it should have been on a new line, but there we are. There's no excuse. So, yeah.
But is that also a picture of having the, not only the physical relationship, but the emotional relationship
absolutely.
As well?
Absolutely. Quite so. Absolutely right. That's the point. Yeah, really. So, as it says there, sex is a gift from God, neither consequence-free nor responsibility-free. And the biblical ethic would be that consent is alone, obviously there has to be consent, but consent alone between two adults is never a sufficient basis for justifying sexual intercourse. So this is a complete contradiction of our culture's view, which was pretty much consent is all that you need. You need two people who consent to have sex. They can be of pretty much any range of genders, and all they need to do is to desire and consent to have sex. And the biblical ethic would be sex is only has meaning as a self-giving between a man and a woman committed to build an entire life together. And what we would see from the Bible story is that if you separate the self from the body and consider it a biological function, not only are you breaking the command of God, but you're actually taking what is a precious thing, your body, and actually using it in a way that that in a way destroys the person or distorts the person or has the danger of destroying the person and will hamper personal development and social stability. There's an interesting thing, I don't know whether to make too much of it, but 1 Corinthians 6:18 is the verse which talks about uniting yourself with a prostitute. I think I mentioned it last week or the week before, that Paul says to Christians, which is interesting, but you know, don't go and sleep with a prostitute, because it's not just about the physical, it's about you taking this temple of the Holy Spirit and uniting it. And he can't just be talking about the physical, he's talking about some kind of emotional uniting that inevitably happens. Now what's mentioned in this book, Love Thy Body, is actually every time you have sex, there's this sort of chemical reaction that actually encourages and induces both a sense of intimacy and commitment. Because, of course, God's form always follows God's desire. So God makes us to kind of function both chemically, biologically, emotionally, spiritually, in the way that he's designed. And she kind of makes a very good point in the book that what that means is if you have sex with someone and you're not committed to them for life, you're basically lying with your body, because your body is telling them you are committed to life, but your person, your mind, is not committed to life. So you're basically lying to them with your body. Now again, as Christians, we would say that being committed is not the thing either, because you might say, well, all that's okay, I get all that, but it's okay if you're just kind of committed, like for a period of time. Because that's all right, because you're committed and you care for somebody. And the biblical ethic would be to say that because of all that marriage is, both in terms of what it's trying to show to the whole world about God and his church, but how it functions in terms of building society, illustrating, demonstrating, being, trusting, about trusting relationships, because of all that, because it's the place where in many cases children will be nurtured, it only works within a lifelong committed relationship of marriage. And so just living together is not enough. There has to be that lifelong commitment. That's the biblical ethic. And apparently, and this might be more of a thing in the States. Are you guys cold? Because I'm really hot up here. But, okay. Stones, you can borrow my coat. Look, nice healthy coat. You want a coat?
I thought it was a girl's coat.
Thanks. it's my coat.
Is it called?
It's a parka. I modelled myself on Jim Nichols. He had one of them. So I wanted to get one like him. Okay, studies have shown, and these are again studies in America, that... now I kind of read this and I thought this can't be true, and then I kind of looked at the sources. Apparently lots of studies have shown that the happiest people are married, middle-aged, conservative Christians. And you might kind of think, well, that's a bit twee, you know, but a little bit pathetic, a little bit kind of self-serving. But if, just as a thought experiment, if God's way is best, people who are fulfilling God's way are going to be happy, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. It'd be like the fruit of what God.
I think so. So it makes sense. Apparently, also, teens who abstain from sex are also more likely to engage in a wide range of other healthy behaviours, from eating breakfast to exercising, to getting enough sleep. They're less likely to smoke, less likely to use drugs, less likely to suffer depression, less likely to report dating violence. Now, all of this is not saying this is why you should do it necessarily, but it just proves that actually, experientially, what happens backs up God's way. And what we need to do is both show the beauty of God and the love that's in Christ. And if people can trust God, then they'll want to do what God commands. But at the same time, I think it's helpful and good to point out that because God is good and beautiful, that what he commands will be a good thing for us ultimately. And so we want to do that. We want to find ways of doing that, don't we? So yeah, that's kind of the end of tonight, pretty much.
It's not actually the end,
is it? Oh, it's not gone on too long.
Yeah, nice one. That's the end of what I formally had to say. So the rest of the time is either asking questions or I'll ask you questions. So try and ask me questions about the whole series and anything about kind of this evening, about how we might better explain it to our friends better and those kind of things. Because I think those would be really useful to do.
Question.
Okay, good. Yes, didn't have its head. Yes.
Have it.
Yes.
I just wondered why.
I worked out
a process in my head that if, for I don't know, if for example that was to happen, in like instead of having an abortion, would you not just go through with the pregnancy, and if the baby died once it got born, then that's God's will, as opposed to interfering before that and killing it off.
Yeah, you could do. I think with the particular condition, I think it was the one where it didn't have a head at all.
At all, okay.
So it was pretty much, and I'm not sure whether maybe as a consequence of that other things weren't developed either. So I I think it was probably alive in the sense that there were biological cells functioning, but I think it was very black and white that there's no way it could function as a human being ever. And perhaps, I don't remember the circumstances, it was before Charlie was born, so how old is she? 30. So it was, you know, 30 years ago, say. I don't think it could survive, and maybe it was dangerous to stay in, I think, maybe because it was so bad. Okay. I think that was a very exceptional sort of case. I wouldn't say the same if you know, maybe had a cleft palate or a Down syndrome or, you know, some other thing that they'll probably be testing for soon, you know. A dodgy eye. Teeth might not grow straight or something. Pardon? Yeah, ginger hair, yeah. So all those sort of trivial things, and perhaps more important things, but to do with mental health issues, I wouldn't support that at all. But I think this was just a very sort of black and white case, I think. Could be wrong, but from my memory. Ask Caroline, because she knows more about circumstances, I think.
Will you remember to get back to us on those resources?
I will. I will, definitely so. So, do you want to talk about your children or your peers first? Children, think about resources and stuff, but...
What do you mean?
Okay. How would you prepare your children for this world?
Homeschool.
Teach them the gospel.
Yes. Teach them the gospel, teach them to love Jesus so they will trust that Jesus' way is good. How else?
I think always to have an open relationship with your children so that they can come to you with anything.
Yep.
You know, not be scared to come and ask you something, even if it's deep and...
Yes.
I mean, we told our two girls about the birds and the bees when they were 5 and 6 years old.
Right.
Because they asked the question, so they gave them the answer.
Yeah.
We never had the conversation again.
No.
Because they didn't, they got the whole story straight
this is really awkward because Adam's here, but my experience is that the younger is better, because by the time they're in secondary school, they're very, very reluctant to talk to you about any of that kind of thing. Whereas younger is better.
Then they still reply with,
ew. Yeah, but at least you've kind of got these conversations. But it's a hard sort of... it's a hard concept to say, well, what is an open relationship? And how do you promote an open relationship? Because I agree with you, but it's hard to work out how do you do that? How do you promote an open relationship with your kids? Yes.
But because if you do shield them from it, when they do eventually, like, they will find out for themselves, or they'll be absolutely horrified, or they'll be like, oh, this is fun, like, why have you been keeping that from me? I'm going to do that. I think you have to...
What does that look like in practice, though? So you're going to sit your kids down and say, you know, this is the birds and the bees thing at 6 and 4? If I just get ages right.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't think it's come up. I think it's
I think they need to be a little bit older than that for it to come up.
I think I my
pardon?
Noah's asked. I can't remember what I said.
He said, well, people just
I did give an answer. And it was a true answer, I don't think I was.
Yeah.
My experience is to answer the questions they ask and not always give them the whole story in answer to the question.
Yeah. I think it's...
progressively answer. But show you're willing to answer. Sorry. Yeah. Go again.
No. I think it's a lot harder to... I don't know what I'm trying to say. It's a lot harder to say to them, like... that you know 100% what's best if you visibly haven't lived that way for a while. Being like, I'll tell them obviously to have babies when you're married, but Violet's not done. She's like, well,
you did. Married.
Yeah. Like, she said that to me actually, like, recently. So it's that's a different kind of challenge, I think, for me.
Because yes.
You're always coming from that slight hypocrisy, I think.
No, but then you're just honest, aren't you? Just say, but I didn't know God then.
Yeah, like, yeah, 100%. You know, but it's like, I think that may invoke more questions of that, like, you know, whereas it, yeah.
That's good, then. But that's good then, isn't it, in a way? Because I think because of that, you know, you're open to have more discussions with her about the world that we live in, and that's what, you know.
Yeah.
I think if you've got, I don't think it's hypocrisy. It's hypocrisy if you're currently... Yeah. You know, living with a bloke who's not your husband and telling them they should. And that's hypocrisy.
Yeah, sure.
I think what you're talking about is past sin, which is different.
Yeah.
And so I think you can, and I think you have to have a, sorry, I'm telling you what to do now, but you have to have a good story, not a good made-up story, but an explanation of not just that was wrong, but you know, just a little bit more about, you know, how you got in that, how that was damaging, if it was, how that wasn't God's plan, how God's, you know, so a bit more of a story, sort of a wraparound.
Yeah.
What do you mean it wasn't God's plan?
It wasn't God's, it was God's secret will, but not God's revealed will. It wasn't God's revealed will, you know. Obviously, in the end, God's sovereign over all events, so even our sin, but it doesn't make the sin right. So it wasn't God's plan in the sense it wasn't what God wanted. It wasn't God's in...
good
forgiveness.
God is. That's not like they have no dad. Do you know what I mean? Like, as in, it,
But it's not, I mean, even, you know, they have friends at schools, you know, Sophia's best friend's parents aren't married.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's just, it's every, you know, it's the world we live in, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, it brings all sorts of questions.
But as kids, we also need to know to show them what God says about it.
Yeah.
It's not what we believe, it's what God says, and the commands He's given. And as far as to not interpret that stuff, but to show them how that fits into their lives to honor God.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, we need to... I'm really into to answering questions as they come up and preparing them for the world that is, one by one, kind of dealing with issues. Even when thinking about Barbie dolls and saying why you think that's not very nice, or why you think boob tops or whatever. Not boob tops, belly tops. Is it belly tops? Boob tubes, belly tops, all those things. Why you think for any age they're not, you know, anything that's kind of drawing attention to the differences between men and women. All those things are kind of worth thinking about. You know, are they good for adults and children? But you also want to encourage your children to be children. So you don't want to over-sexualize your children by trying to prepare them for the sexualized world. So, you know, deal with stuff as they come along, but don't feel like you're then obsessed with preparing them for this world. Yeah, quite. So... It is, which is why we need to pray. It's why we need to pray for each other and sometimes talk to each other, not to everybody about what we're currently talking to our kids about, but sometimes kind of say, you know, because that's part of being in the church family. Lots of people are at slightly different stages. So some people have got teenagers and they can tell you, you know, what their experiences were as a bit older on, and some people have got grown-up children, blah, 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 all that stuff. Some people have got children the same age as you currently, and then you can kind of, yeah, share stories to some degree. Yeah, but also let them be children. So there is a degree of protection. I know, Matthew, you're only joking about not letting them out, but there is a degree of... you don't just say, OK, I've got to totally prepare my child and now I'm going to go and let them go and watch pornography because I've so prepared them that they're ready. You know, they don't have the capacity to do that. So monitoring what they watch, to some degree... thinking about their friendships and their influences is worth thinking about. You're not trying to stop them, you know, we're not into that, but sometimes friendships and influences are taking them faster than you want them to go, and it's not helping them. It's worth thinking about, I think. Is that a bit controversial saying that? I don't know. Oh, yeah?
He was talking about the same question. How do you bring up children in a pornographic culture?
And just that, like, to make sure they've got, like, solid Christian friends.
Yeah.
Like, not to, like, completely segregate them from, like, other non-Christian friends, but just make sure that you've got relationships with, like, strong, like, Christian people.
And he was just saying, like, you don't want to encourage them to have strong relationships with people who aren't Christians, because they will just...
Yeah.
Or like children of completely non-Christians. Not that you don't be friends with them, but like you don't want that to be their primary relationships, because they'll always want to do different things as they grow up.
Do you guys all agree with that?
Yeah.
I think it's to be friends with the world, but not be in the world.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes a difficult balance to set, because I know with one of our daughters, you tell her, I really don't like this friend of yours, and that's the one that she would hang on to, like, for dear life, until she realised that mom and dad were right. You know, and then the other daughter, you'd say, this one's not so good, and she would walk away straight away. You know, so two kids in the same household, different personalities, different ways of thinking.
But even children from Christian families may not be Christians.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. So if you're encouraging a friendship, then they might turn out to be even worse.
Like, this is true.
So it's not necessarily
so,
guaranteed.
No, but...
Obviously it's better.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, people who will be doing the same stuff and learning the same stuff.
You know, people around that
can't be close. It's important to have solid...
Be
solid Christian relationships there.
Again, it's a matter of balance.
Yeah. But it's funny because I don't remember ever having like Christian friends, I think, age growing up. Mm. Like none of the friends I hung out with.
No. No, this is true.
Well, that's also true.
Because I would, I was just.
Were you just processing that?
No, I wasn't processing you didn't have any friends. I was just processing the fact that I'm just telling you guys to do what I didn't necessarily do with my own children.
Yeah.
There were friends that I didn't want you to be friends with, but that was.
Who was that?
Who were they?
All of them.
Not easy being a
parent. I used to think I didn't like Ben Gundry coming around because he was rude. Because he was always very rude and obnoxious, but actually he's turned out to be very nice. And he came to your wedding and he was very pleasant. So there we go. But he's not a believer. But it wasn't really to do with him being a believer, not being a believer.
No, but then knowing Adam, you know, then their friendship might be a good witness to him to want to.
It could be. I think it wasn't. There wasn't for your. Sorry, I don't want to get a whole analysis about the Nichols children, but there weren't very many children your age in the church. But what you benefited from, I think, which I was going to recommend anyway, was different age group people who were your friends. So when our children were young, they had the blessing of people kind of Keturah's age who did a lot of stuff with our kids and were kind of role models for them. So they weren't their parents. They were in between their parents and them. And they kind of babysat, but they hung out with us quite a lot.
What's the age gap?
Keturah would be like 20 years younger than me. No, yeah, ish.
She's
40.
Years older than
what?
10 years older than
Charlie.
She's 38, so she's 8 years older. But,
She's 38,
so
she's
8 years older. But,
Is that Hannah Kirby?
Yeah.
Is that Hannah Kirby?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I was that close to my
In age, yeah.
Yeah, that is true, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Keturah, we're not going to be a good example, but there were younger people too as well, a little bit younger than Keturah.
Yeah. That's the great thing about the church, isn't it? Like, when we all hang out, we've got, like, the twins, and then Sophia, who's, every age in between, they all get on so well.
But it's good to think about slightly older friendships. So like that, I know they're not all believers necessarily, but the Hannah Koenig, Eleanor Gray generation age group, thinking about getting them to babysit for you and stuff, and like you do with Hannah and her sometimes, but they're all good. And if they cultivate a relationship with your kids, that's a very positive thing. So sometimes you have to be intentional about that.
Yeah.
Think about that. So it's definitely something to think about. In the end, it's the grace of God that will both save them and preserve them from any of these things. But God uses means, and all these things might help. So talking, being ready to answer questions. I can waffle for like 15 minutes, can't I?
A lot more than that.
Yeah. Ho-hum. Okay. How do we talk to our adults? We haven't finished yet. You're giving me the... Yes, this... We're talking about adults now. So how do you talk to your adult friends about this sort of thing?
Non-Christians.
Yes, non-Christian adult friends. All Christian adult friends come to that.
Just as it arises.
You
don't.
Yeah. You not be friends with them.
No. If you're in a situation, isn't it? I mean, it's probably not something you just bring up, on the playground.
Well, like, for example, like a classic example,
we're all quaking here.
Didn't you have a friend that wanted to take? Was it you that wanted to take their kids to Lissy Little Mix?
Yeah. So there's always all friends keep going.
And then they would be like, "Oh, do you want to come?"
Exactly. And I said why? And they're not friends with you.
Would anyone be brave enough to ever have the conversation like the stuff we've been talking about this evening with someone, not in the playground necessarily, but a friend who's in a relationship that's not a God-honouring relationship, or maybe it's all breaking apart, and kind of talking to them about the biblical sex ethic? Or do you think that they have to be a Christian first, or you can't talk about this stuff?
No,
depends on the person.
No.
Philip, here's an example. My sister.
You
are? Like, this is what Philip did, so I'm just giving you the story. I'm the only Christian in my family, so just bear with me.
Yes.
So my sister, just older than me, was in a relationship with a guy for a long time, and then it broke up, and she moved to another city and had a one-night stand with a guy and felt pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she came back, and she was living with us just after the baby was born. And I don't know if she took the baby with her, but anyway, she came back to our house with a guy, and the guy slept in our house.
Right.
You know, with her. And the first thing Philip did that morning, he took her aside and he said to her,
quietly,
you know, we've got two young children in our house. We do not condone what you're doing. You cannot do this in our house. Well, she moved out a week later because she wanted to continue that sort of love. So he was prepared to say, these are the standards that are in our house, what we are trying to impress on our children, and therefore cannot be done under our roof. What you do outside mm-hmm. our roof,
right,
you know, is not really our concern, although we are concerned about what you are doing.
And if anybody comes to visit us and they're not married, they will not sleep in the same bed.
Yeah.
And that would be told to them in
before,
a nice way.
Yeah, before they...
Under no circumstance will that happen.
Yeah.
You guys are very direct, aren't you? You're just straight.
Look at the
People know where you stand, and you know, I mean, she, in a way, she respected. We still have a very good relationship, you know.
Yeah.
Even though her language is very colourful and her lifestyle is not right, but you know, she respects me, and we get on.
Yeah. See, we were talking about that though, as in. Would me and Adam let like a non-married couple stay in our house? And I was like, no, not at all. But none of my family are Christians, and my dad isn't a Christian. He's got a girlfriend. And then I was like, well, would I let them stay? And then like it was really weird because obviously it's your dad who's like an authoritative figure, and would you then tell him that he's wrong? It was weird, because I'd never thought...
Philip would. Just get Philip to come round.
No exceptions.
Yeah, I've just never thought of it like that.
Thank goodness we haven't heard that situation.
Yeah. I never thought of it like that, and it's like... Obviously, you can't have one rule for one or for the other.
No.
And you can't, what are you saying to your children in the house with you if you allow that, even if it is your dad? Like,
yeah.
So it was just interesting for me to think about.
I
was going to say something else. It's gone now.
I was going to say something else. What? Just that you don't really have conversations about relationships. Not in my work, anyway. It's either like someone talking about their girlfriend or wife, I don't know. I think this is all like, it's all very like principle and like conceptual.
Yeah, but it depends where you are, because in like the shop where I work in, we get a lot of like regular customers who are like mid 20s to 30 lads, like builderish, who like you get to know because they come in and you see them every day, and then you develop some kind of like, not a relationship, but you say, oh, you're up to your head, and all that. You know, I not easy, but there are definitely times where, like, everyone knows that I'm a Christian because there is, if you can find ways in, like, there's a lad, it's really sad actually, who comes in who's was going out with a girl for like 2 weeks, and now she's pregnant and he doesn't want nothing to do with her, and I'm like, that's wrong. We have like debates about it, and he thinks that what I'm saying is rubbish because I'm a Christian. And I was like, well, even if I'm not a Christian, it's still not great. Like,
so you have opportunities to talk about it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I hope this hasn't been a waste of time these 4 weeks in that Adam can never talk about it with anybody. But I think even if you can't have like deep conversations that use this material directly, I think having it as a kind of background thought that's kind of thinking, I understand now why you're living like this. Maybe I can't articulate with you quite yet, but maybe I will one day, but at least I understand. And I just repeat what I've said quite a few times, is that when it comes to the biblical sexual ethics and the view of the body, it's both comes with the authority of God, but it's good. And you have to, sometimes we because we're so keen on making sure we emphasize the authority of God, that we don't emphasize that it's also good. And I think I've tried to show, I have tried to show over these weeks, that it's also good. What God commands us to do is what he equips us to do with the way our bodies are made, the way our minds are made, the way everything works, equips us for lifelong committed relationships between a man and a woman. That's how he equips our body, and we love our bodies if we do that and seek to honour that. I will say one more thing, which I said at the beginning, which is that we need to remember the gospel. We haven't been perfect in these areas that we've been talking about, and people in our church have not been perfect, and we know that in areas that we're talking about here. So we don't kind of end these sessions feeling all self-righteous. We're all sinners who need the gospel, and we are people who want to tell the gospel. So let me pray and then end.